Hello, and welcome to AssertSoftwareQuality.com AudioCast, Beyond Use Cases, How to Achieve Success with Software Requirements. Our speaker is Ellen Gottesdiener, Principal Consultant at EBG Consulting. I'm Jan Stafford, Executive Editor at AssertSoftwareQuality.com, and the interviewer for today's AudioCast. This AudioCast interview is a companion to Ellen's AssertSoftwareQuality.com webcast titled Success with Requirements Beyond Use Cases. You'll find that in the webcast section of AssertSoftwareQuality.com. Thanks for joining us, Ellen.
Thanks, Jan. Glad to be here.
Now, for our listeners, if you have any problems with the sound or quality of the audio cast, please write to us at editor@AssertSoftwareQuality.com, and our tech support team will get in touch with you within 24 hours. Now let's get started with our interview. Ellen, you talked about misuses of use cases in your webcast. You talked about misuses of form, function, creation, and consumption. What are you seeing as the most common misuses of use cases?
Okay, that's a great question. I think the two big ones that come to mind are this idea of overpacking and the other one I mentioned called ostrich, and those both happen to be misuses of function. In overpacking, what I see teams doing is throwing the kitchen sink inside the use case. So it's packed with data, business rules, information about the initiating actor or the user. It's just overwhelming and brimming over with information, and it really violates that really important concept that we talked about in the webcast called separation of concerns. So it's, let's just throw everything we possibly can think of in there. And one of the biggest problems with that, aside from the fact that it's just plain darn ununderstandable, it's hard to read and follow, is that if you're doing, you know, your use cases properly, you're iterating through those and you're learning and adapting and changing how you're capturing the requirement. So when you've thrown a lot of stuff into it, it's hard to pull things out and separate them out. So it's kind of like a cartoon character that you might have seen where somebody's leaning over a garbage can trying to throw things out looking for one single thing. So this overpacking causes all kinds of problems in maintaining and iterating through the requirements. The other one that I mentioned around function also is the ostrich. And this is where that's all we use, just use cases. We bury our head in the sand and just think about the behavioral requirements, and we ignore business rules, we ignore data, we ignore the effect of time. And we don't link any quality attributes to the use cases. So those are the two big ones. And I guess to some extent, there's the misuse of overuse, the universal use. That was one I mentioned in misuse of consumption, where we use use cases even when it's not appropriate, like when it's a data-oriented domain or if we're using if we're trying to acquire a COTS package, a commercial off-the-shelf software package, or implement that kind of a environment where we don't really need use case specifications, but that's what we know how to do, so we're going to do it. So that, I guess, those would be the top ones for me, Jan.
Ellen, why or when would you utilize use cases instead of other behavioral models?
Okay, well, I think it would be useful to talk about some of those other behavioral models and then come back, loop back to your question, Jan. When I mentioned behavioral models, I would say some of the examples of those, aside from use cases, would be an activity diagram, which may or may not use all the UML notation, and swim lanes, a process map, which many people really think of as a swim lane diagram, or it also could be something like a SIPOC diagram, which folks that are familiar with Six Sigma are used to, which stands for supplier, input, output, and provider. Then there's stories, which we use on agile projects, scenarios, data flow diagrams. So those are all examples of behavioral models. Now, when you asked about using use cases, when I think of use cases, most of the time I'm thinking of the textual use case. Some people think of use cases and what pops into your mind is the oval, with the stick figure for the actor attached to it. The oval has the name of the use cases inside of it. So there's really two forms of a use case, that visual use case, which doesn't tell you too much, and the textual use case, which has all those elements like the header and the brief description and the stepwise or sequence with variations and exceptions and so forth. So one thing I would think of is, what's the environment like? What are people used to using? What's the customer familiar with? And what is the team that is eliciting requirements familiar with? If use cases are already part of their practice, their culture, and traditional projects as opposed to agile projects are very much familiar, a lot of them are familiar with use cases, then why switch over? But what I might also want to think about is mixing the format of the behavioral models to include a visual model. So we might use, for some use cases that are more complex, so we're going to be selective here, not for every use case, but some, we might use a process map or an activity diagram. So we actually supplement one behavioral model use cases with another behavioral model, like a process map. If also another case, Jan, that I'm going to think about is using use cases is on a COTS project, so a commercial off-the-shelf software project, I don't want to do really detailed use case specification. I would want to use lightweight use cases, a name of a use case, which is essentially the goal, and a brief description, which could be one or two sentences. So I have to be careful about my use of use cases on those projects. And again, I'm going to supplement with something visual for complex use cases. So I'm going to look at the project, the culture, to decide about using use cases. If they're familiar with it, then just applying it usefully, like proper use of use case and not misuse of use case, would seem to make a lot of sense to me.
So in your webcast, you discussed separation of concerns and included control, which is about business rules. Many products rely on business rules, and so analysts need to define those somehow as part of user requirements. How should you handle business rules, and what's their relationship to other analysis models?
Yes, that's a great topic that I have a lot of passion about. In the webcast, I showed the Venn diagram with three interlocking circles with the business rules, or really controls, what it said at the core, which really are business rules. What we're talking about are the policies, the regulations, guidelines, standard that must be adhered to. And most of the time, we capture those as textual statements. And, you know, if we don't get that right, then the product's not going to be right. They have to serve, these business rules have to serve a higher goal. So let's say you're selling something online and people are buying your products online. You're going to have rules around how you calculate the final amount, around shipping, around discounting. So even if you take something like discounting schemes or your discounting business rules, those should be based on some motivation that is going to further the business. So, for example, you provide discounts to returning customers because we're going to encourage them to come back and buy more of our product. It's certainly cheaper to maintain customers than to acquire new customers. So business rules are really, really critical. What we have to be careful about doing is burying them, overpacking them in something like use cases or really any other model. So separating them out through that idea of separation of concerns, capturing them, a couple ways to do it, capturing them in a business rule repository, a business dictionary. There's different names for these things, but pulling them out as separate when you're actually going to maintain documentation about the rules. This allows other projects, other applications, other parts of your community to access them without going and burying into different models. So sort of like we think about on data modeling, a very key expression people familiar with the data model is one fact in one place. One fact, one place. So you don't have orphan data, for example, or you don't have the same piece of data represented with different values or formats in different applications. Same thing is true with business roles. We should have one rule, one fact in one place, one rule in one place that everybody consistently accesses. So pull those out of something like your use cases or your events or your data model. Going back to that image of the Venn diagram, you know, really, if you were to create models of all those other views, the other ones being behavior, structure, and dynamics, and create them to their anal retentive glory in a lot of detail, the union of all those models would encapsulate the business rules. But let's be realistic. When you elicit requirements, you're not going to model yourself into a black hole and create all these different models at a lot of detail and granularity. So you've got to get the rules, and you've got to get them right. And use cases can be very, very useful as a way to harvest those business rules. And then what I found, combining scenarios or snippets of stories as a testing tool, you can walk through your use cases with your rules as separated in a rule repository and find missing and erroneous rules, as well as potentially problems in your use case steps. So we've got to get the rules, and we've got to get them right. We have to keep them separate from the other analysis models like use cases, yet link them. And that's where some form of traceability, even if it's as simple as putting it in an Excel spreadsheet, where we can trace a step or a use case to those rules, is really, really helpful. And then finally, if I'm working on an Agile project, we'll actually have test cases that will be the expression or articulation of our business rules.
So, Ellen, what are techniques that you use for eliciting behavioral requirements?
Well, there are a variety of elicitation techniques, and quite frankly, I have a personal bias toward facilitated workshops, which is the topic of the first book I wrote, Requirements by Collaboration, because there's a lot of benefits in using workshops where you get the right people together, well-timed workshops, enable the community to agree on a lot of core issues, including scope, what's in, what's out of scope, and then with the right people there, get to the more detailed requirements. So I really favor facilitated workshops, but I have to say a caveat is that it is not the only technique, and you should use a combination of techniques. And the elicitation techniques you use really need to be tailored to the type of products and the stakeholders from whom we need to elicit. For example, a same time, same place workshop is not going to be feasible when we're in a distributed team and the customers are spread out all across the world, and for whatever reason, we're not able to get people together periodically to elicit the requirements. So the fallback position in elicitation is interviews. And when I poll people at conferences or on site at clients and I ask what is the most common technique and show them a list of the common elicitation techniques, interviews is the one that always seems to pop up the first. But there's a lot of problems with interviews because it's a serial process, and when we find conflicts, we have to go back, and it just takes longer. But the other thing that, so I would suggest look at a variety of techniques beyond just interviews, include workshops, and I really like combining prototyping as an elicitation technique to whichever other ones you use, such as focus groups or survey and research-based approaches. A low-fidelity prototype or a mock-up is cheap and fast, and it also communicates to the customer, okay, we talked about what you need to do to accomplish this goal, such as a use case, which is a behavioral requirement, but how would that look? Here's some examples of some flows of screen. Is this the flow that makes sense? So you get immediate feedback. And what I find when you do that is that customers kind of start to take control and tell you what that flow should be. So when they can do that and take the marker, take the pen, or explain things so that you can visualize as well as describe in text format, you're going to have a much richer understanding of the requirements. So mix the elicitation techniques. And then I would also suggest that folks listen to the webcast coming up that Mary Gorman is going to be doing on elicitation as well. She's going to give you some really good ideas to consider in addition to these comments that I'm making right now.
So, Ellen, what about agile projects? Do you use cases there? And if not, what else do you use?
Yeah, this is often a big puzzle for folks that are transitioning to agile and are used to use cases. The fact is that on most agile projects, we use user stories. Or stories, I should say, globally, because there's more than just user stories. Now, what do I mean by a story? A story is like a single path or a single scenario through your use case specification. It's like that, roughly, but actually it's usually a bit smaller than that. And when I capture a user story on our Agile project well, I also encapsulate some user acceptance test information, or at least completion criterion. So if I have a user story of find the cost of buying a product, I might have a much smaller user story that I would start out with, which is find the cost of a single product. And I'd have test data and business rules encapsulated in that user acceptance test data. So it wouldn't be a full-blown use case where it's finding pricing on a variety of different products, that some might be shipped in different ways and so forth. I'm just going to take a bite at a time with our user stories. Now, well, what about use cases in that situation? Well, actually, use cases can be useful because we could use our use cases if we're careful, and don't go down into too much detail, if we're careful and keep it at a name and a brief description level and don't go down into a specification level, we can use use cases to understand the feature set in a release or even to understand the whole grouping or categories of feature for a whole product. So where I found use cases useful on user on agile projects is when we're doing product road mapping and release planning. And then I can name those use cases. I could even lay them out if I want to put the name of a use case onto an oval post-it and lay it out on the wall with the customer in a sequence so you kind of see a flow. That also helps people visualize what the big set of features are. And then what I'm going to do is partition those use cases down into stories, and those will then be allocated to different releases. So I'm just going to use it as a hook, if you will, but I'm not going to use it to actually build the product with. In that case, at an iteration level, user stories are much, much more usable. And we'll be talking actually about this, Jan, in our third of the series on Agile.
Great. Well, that's my last question. I really appreciate you talking with me today, Ellen.
It's my pleasure. I hope folks will visit our site and some of the resources, as well as the resource, the TechTarget resource that's hanging off our site related to this series.
Thanks again, Ellen. That concludes today's audiocast on use cases and requirements. This is Jan Stafford signing off. Have a great day.